Okay, so they didn't take out the leading otter and they didn't take out second or third price, but it says all other samples were excellent. Several of them ought to have been placed by the judges, and it was just a very, very close contest. And he even went as far as to say it shouldn't have been a competitive show. All exhibits were excellent, so the cheese factory certainly wasn't disgraced. However, after the Melbourne exhibition, during the 1880s, the factory appears to have flourished. If this next article in the South Bourke and Mornington Journal was anything to go on. June 11, 1884, the marriage of one of the daughters of Murdoch MacDonald at Berwick to Mr. W. Leckie was celebrated with great adarm. The invitations were numerous and most were accepted. Consequently, the wedding party was a large one. The arrangements were made regardless of expense and must have cost something considerable. There's an unusually set out very late breakfast and the party enjoyed themselves dancing into the evening. Once again, the popularity of Murdoch MacDonald, but he certainly wasn't a man of no means at that time. However, during the 1880s, the plan of MacDonald's at the cheese factory, their numbers dwindled quite substantially from a few events. And they were to dwindle so far that it was dramatically to affect the possible longevity of the cheese factory operation. In 1880, Murdoch's oldest daughter Flora married and died the following year. In 1882, John died. Next slide, please. This is his death certificate. Died of cancer. Farmer. Yeah, died of cancer. 1882. In 1884, Malcolm and his family moved to Marnoo. So they lost another brother. He just moved out of the property. I don't know why. In 1884, Elizabeth married, and in 1888, Murdoch's other daughter Margaret married, and also tragically in 1888, Murdoch's youngest son David died of an asthma attack at age 22. Next slide. And this is his death certificate here, died of an asthma attack. And at this stage, of all the married girls had left the property with their husbands. All that were left at the property was Murdoch, his son Kenneth, and his youngest daughter Anne. Three people. Next slide, please. Okay, this is a picture of the family grave in the cemetery at Berwick. We've got Elizabeth up the top, Flora, John MacDonald, Murdoch MacDonald later, Margaret Hooper, as she married Mr. Hooper. She lived to 89 years of age. Kenneth, who died, he lived to a long life as well. And there's also the daughter of Margaret Hooper. The son of Margaret Hooper and their only son. And he was killed at Anzac in 1915. And it was in 1888 that Murdoch MacDonald left the property. And it was also during the 1880s that other tenants moved on to other sections of the property. Next slide. Okay, we had Mr. Edwin Greaves leasing out this part of it, and we had a Mr. Frederick Poole leasing out that section there. Next slide. Okay, this is a copy of the Berwickshire rate books. We've gone back to 1876 here. We've got Murdoch, Malcolm and John, 3,180 acres, sections 25, 26 and 35 to 38, and we also note here that by 1882 Murdoch MacDonald had purchased himself a town lot at New Berwick, as it was called then. Next slide, please. Okay, we have 1884. There was still Murdoch and Malcolm there, and that was also when Frederick Poole was started to lease his block, and also Edwin Greaves came in as well. Okay, 1886, it was in the name of Murdoch and Miss Margaret, his daughter, same again there, that by 1889 Edwin Greaves had taken over the lease of the whole spring property, and there's no evidence we found yet to say that cheesemaking continued with Edwin Greaves. He was a more a breeder of, he was a stud breeder. So we basically believe that it was in 1888 that the cheese factory closed down prematurely. Cheese wasn't unviable at that time, and other producers continued up to 1890 and up to the turn of the century. There was no evidence that the industry suffered any decline. Still in that time, if you could just turn out a cheese that was reasonable quality, that's all you had to do at that time. It was difficult to make, it's all you had to do. You didn't have to produce fantastic things, just turn out a good cheese that was fine enough. I can't tell you too much about Frederick Poole, but I did find one article in the South Burlington Journal. It's local intelligence, that's their news section. The fame of Mr. F. Poole's Big Pig. Now, I'll just point out here as well, I believe this is a Frederick Poole. We can't be too certain with names, I'll come to that later. Bought him 50 guineas. There was a fellow that had the pig and couldn't sell it. Frederick Poole bought it. It became a tourist attraction in the area. Everyone came up to see this giant pig. And he sold it later, and the person who purchased it used it for exhibitions later on. So possibly that's our man there, Mr. Frederick Poole. Okay. What happened to Murdoch MacDonald after he left the property was a bit of a bone of contention as to what happened. Originally, it was believed that he moved to Cranbourne and that's where he died. Next slide, thanks. This is the original death certificate we had for Murdoch MacDonald. Murdoch MacDonald, farmer, died Cranbourne. I was too inexperienced at this time to understand that that was a section for children. This is the wrong death certificate. I woke up to this fact by the next line. When I was doing my research, there was a post office directory, like it was like a yellow pages at that time, which had Murdoch MacDonald, Lyndhurst South, which is virtually on the western border of this property, could have even been a neighbour. Murdoch MacDonald, Spring Station, Berwick, right next to each other. Later on in the South Burke and Mornington Journal, we've got Murdoch MacDonald, formerly resident of Lyndhurst, in Cranbourne. He'd become blind and the Cranbourne Council were going to pay him a pension of £4 per annum. So, Murdoch MacDonald of Cranbourne, formerly of Lyndhurst, from then. And just to make sure of it, the next week he wrote back and said he didn't need the £4. And that once again they said Murdoch MacDonald, formerly of Lyndhurst. If it was a mistake, they repeated it twice. But anyway, it's proved incorrect. Anyway, if we look at the next death certificate, this is a death certificate of Murdoch MacDonald. Died of cancer of the liver, exhaustion, died in the Alfred Hospital. Father John the Cooper, he didn't come out to Australia, possibly deceased when they came out, because remember Flora was aged 57 years of age. Buried at Berwick Cemetery, from Ken Taylor, West Coast, Scotland. Married in Ballarat, Victoria to Elizabeth Tulloch. And here's the list of his children. The pink ones are the ones highlighted, are the ones that had died by 1909 when Murdoch MacDonald died. The only surviving children were Margaret and Kenneth, as pointed out before. Next slide, thanks. It was from Murdoch MacDonald's will that I discovered that he was living in New G East. He only moved to Melbourne towards his dying days, and he was in the house with that was shared by Margaret Hooper and Kenneth in Albert Park. They were living together at that time, and once again, they were in there getting on a bit of news themselves. 22 Bridge Street, Albert Park. He willed to Margaret and Kenneth equal shares in his property at New G East, but also to Margaret's son, Robert Hooper, who was killed at Anzac. He was willed half interest in brown coal deposits, Glen Tulloch property, Thorpedale. And that was, to Robert Hooper, son of Margaret. Next slide, thanks. Okay. Thanks, Nick. Okay. This is a copy of Murdoch MacDonald's probate. His will was only his wishes of what was to happen there. He had his property at UG East. He had an 80-pound mortgage, and the property was worth about £300. Another property at Tangill, which is near New G, that was owned by Sir William Clark. Obviously a mate of Sir William Clark after the factory closed down. There couldn't have been too hard of feelings. But the biggest mystery of all, the debt to the estate of Sir William Clark at that time. Sir William died in 1897. £13,108. The debt was written off by they just accepted the property as satisfaction of the debt, and the other property that Murdoch owned was still able to be willed to Margaret and Kenneth. So the estate of the late Sir William Clark at that time weren't too fussed about £13,000. They probably didn't even know it occurred. The family historian Michael Clark, who's a grandson of our William Clark, who built the cheese factory, he's still the executor of the will of William Clark. Recently he found out that the estate of William Clark owned a street in Bensdale. The council wrote a letter to him saying, "You own this street the estate owns this street in Bensdale." Quite a huge will to divide up. Could have even been Big Clark's will, I don't know. So that's where we wind up the story on Murdoch MacDonald. We'll just continue on with what happened to William Clark from 1880 onwards. After the Melbourne exhibition, he travelled to England, and on his return back to Australia was bestowed a baronetcy. Now that made him Sir William Clark, but a baronetcy is a hereditary title. Quite a title to get. He must have been quite a charmer also when he went over to England. He got the baronetcy for his contribution to the 1880 exhibition. He organised lavish functions for all the international guests at his own expense. And it was also awarded for personal merit for his contributions made to the people of Victoria at that time. He was an uninterrupted representative on the Legislative Assembly. And by the way, Big Clark was a long-time representative of the Legislative Assembly. He was not a very active member, but when he announced that he was standing down in his second last term, his constituents rallied him to stand again, and he was elected another time. That's how popular he was. He was a prominent Freemason, and he was the inaugural Grand Master of the United Grand Lodge, which was a combination of the English, combined the English, Irish, and Scottish constitutions. In agriculture, he remained a committee member of agricultural societies right across Victoria. He donated very generous prizes for rewarding excellence in farming, and also generous prizes to his Dowling Forest tenants. Oh yes, I just got a picture of William again. I can't read my thing now. My torch guide's gone out. He donated a lot of money to charity, a lot of money to the arts. I just mentioned the Ballarat Art School before. £10,000 to the Indian Famine Relief Fund, £7,000 to Trinity College at Melbourne University, but he donated money to all classes of society. In 1885, he travelled to England and was given an honorary Doctorate of Law at Cambridge University upon a visit there. And he was also well known for his lavish receptions that he held at his mansion at Rupert's Wood, serviced by his own railway platform just out of Sunbury to bring all the guests up from Melbourne. He was chairman of the Colonial Bank. In the 1880s, the bank got involved in speculation and the bank crashed in 1890. Sir William Clark met all calls with his own money, and that was quite a considerable sum. He bailed out a bank. However, the stress of the Colonial Bank was probably one of the possible causes that led to his sudden death. He died of a heart attack on the 15th of May 1897. And when this occurred, there was an extraordinary edition of the Herald printed immediately. He was so popular that the news spread around Melbourne, they believe, within 2 hours. The governor of Victoria flew the flag at half-mast. And it was one of the largest funerals ever held in Victoria. I'll give you a couple of photographs of the... Okay, this is leaving St. Paul's Cathedral. You can see all the people there. The next one's very telling, though. This is Swanston Street, Melbourne. We better try and get that focused as best we can. That's it. Swanston Street, Melbourne. You know, at least 20 people thick down the length of Swanston Street on the trip up to Melbourne Cemetery. Virtually stopped the state for a whole day. One of the biggest funerals ever seen in Victoria. Okay, he was also commemorated by a statue in the Treasury Gardens, which is still there today. This is his memorial at Melbourne Cemetery, next to his father, Big Clark. You can see the city buildings in the background. I just included them to give a bit of context. Next one. Okay, this is the statue of Sir William Clark. Bart, LLD, MLC, Member of Legislative Council. This is the Treasury Buildings. This is an example of not how to take a photograph of a statue. I don't think Sir William had that hairstyle. Next slide, please. This is the statue as I would normally photograph it. Okay, next slide, please. And last one here. This is in the South Bourke and Mornington Council. I can't pronounce his name. Viewstone, thank you very much. Can't even read it there when it's blown up. This is a meeting of the Berwickshire Council. He raised the motion that a letter of condolence be sent to Lady Clark. The move was seconded and passed unanimously. And he was sent for recognition that he was a big contributor to the Berwick area and also a big ratepayer for a long time. Okay, and so just summarising the history here, what this history does is that it shows that it was actually Sir William Clark who was the man behind the cheese factory, but he was helped, of course, by Big Clark's wealth that was accumulated beforehand. Helped to be able to build such an elaborate factory with had the capital resources. If it wasn't for him and his influence, we probably wouldn't have got that article in the South Bourke Mornings and Journal talking about the cheese factory. Research would have been extremely difficult. We wouldn't have even known who Murdoch MacDonald was. We wouldn't have even known that that building was a cheese factory. We wouldn't have known anything about that, except from rumours around that it was a cheese factory, but there would have been no proof. It's also it's a full appreciation of the important role that Sir William Clark fulfilled in Victorian history, and it won him universal acclaim by all classes of society at the time, as the funeral showed you. He was Australian born, he totally committed his wealth towards the development of Victoria, a sadly forgotten person in Victoria's history. If you mention the name Sir William Clark, it doesn't mean a lot to a lot of people, but that's the calibre of the man we're talking about. His history is probably just one thing that maybe helped revive a bit of the contribution of Sir William Clark to Victoria. It also reflects the highs and lows of pioneer life in our local district. A 16-year-old shepherd migrating to Australia, Murdoch MacDonald would never have dreamed that he would have that he was destined for such great things, but it also showed how when he outsurvived his wife and four of his six children, how rapidly, even the grandest of endeavours could be swept away in those times. And I trust this also just a message to the friends, I trust this history They felt as some repayment to the friends and the city of Berwick for saving and restoring this great historic site. And I'd also like to thank Connie Wooten, who helped me earlier on with this study, and very much to Dr. Stefan, or Debbie, here tonight. They both gave a lot of help in helping me put this presentation together. And we're intending to print a slightly more detailed history in the form of a booklet, and that's what we believe is our next project, with a couple of others with the old cheese factory. The history has been quite exciting for me to research, and thank you for attending.
Possibly understated in value. In the early days of Berwick, there's a reference to
woodcutter sawyers at the time, woodcutters, lowest paid people, hardest work you could get, lowest paid, dreadful pay, disgusting pay actually. So the materials
well,
probably
surprising
been
because,
a great deal.
I read a book just recently, the Jones guy, about sleeper cutters. They were getting 1 and 9 pence a sleeper in the early 1880s.
Well, this is
that was going back to down to Curran Railway, which was a lot of money. They were well thought of and well paid.
I can't answer that point, but the early days of Berwick is talking about early development of Berwick around about the 1840s, 1850s, which is
I find it difficult to believe that they accept that sort of money.
Well, if you want to just update the knowledge, then it's in the very early parts of the early days of Berwick, there's a description there that might increase your knowledge. As I said, he was accused of undervaluing the property. Also, there was Forrest and Monteith there for 7 years, and then Robert Henry there for some time. Naturally, they would have cleared the property and improved it, so some of those fences might have been earlier work by other people. So it might not have been the McDonald brothers that put in those fences. So it was originally settled.
Yeah, what I'm getting at, the area here, I wouldn't have thought it would have been that timbered area.
It's a tea tree swamp there, but
being a swamp.
The area around Dandenong was red gum forest.
Yeah, I realise that.
So there was plenty of timber around.
Yeah, but to get from Dandenong to here must have been a cost. The cost that mentioned there is just ridiculous.
Also on that old parish map, there's a reference that the lowland areas here are tea tree swamp, but it said this area of the cheese factory on was a gum tree area originally. It's got that written on the map. So there were trees in the higher areas. And even Berwick, the town side of Berwick itself was a forest as well. So it was only the tea tree was this is the lower areas were the swamp because that's where the tea tree was. Another interesting point was I've only done up to 1900. In 1834, there was a description that someone took of a man that was in the area in the 1930s. He said that this is another aspect of George Brown. The cheese factory built on the top of the hill. It was a landmark in the area. They chopped down all the trees. There weren't trees around it like there is today. He was a landmark to be seen in the area. Rupert's Wood in Sunbury was also built on a hill. Typical George Brown style to build it like that. So, it was put on the hill for drainage as well.
Yes.
So, there's any way getting into this, there was an article later on that was way in the soil. If that raised up and stunk, then you just had to shut down the factory altogether. But one designed this well, I can't imagine them making that mistake. Yes.
You were wondering about when you may have got the information about cheese. Did you notice the publisher of that book was a hawker and Mary Baldwin was one of the... There's a connection there somewhere.
Oh, right.
The Baldwin family or something.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's got the names of the people that went out to sort the cheese.
On the page of the book about cheese making, the bottom it had publisher Hawker and some stuff under. Or Mary Hawker was one of the early...
There's quite a
big connection somewhere.
It's one thing about this history. I mean, it's a story there. All I had was combination. All I had was just a pile of about 300 facts. Took a lot of working through them to mould it all together. So every little bit helps. I think in the history, in the written history, I'll give the names of the people that did that search. But they sent a fellow over to Great Britain and he went around to all the areas and spoke to the authorities on the subject. So it was a very thorough bit of research and as I said, went to 4 editions at the same will.
Yes? Can I ask, that particular book we discussed, was it published overseas?
Published in Australia.
In Australia.
Yep, and it was for Australian farmers. It was an Australian publication for Australian farmers.
Following that survey overseas.
Yeah, and it would have arisen at the time of the start of the cheddar making period.
The English cheddar.
It was similar to something William Clark would have done. It was probably a money making exercise to publish it, but the value to Victoria of that publication in itself is that people were making first class cheese and following its directions. Amazing book.
the only interesting point is that although Australia was so far away from the UK in that day, that was the time we were right up to date in that cheese making, but only just prior to that, the cheddar cheese making, which to be famous for the village of cheddar, was all to go in England.
Mm.
And very quickly it got to America here.
Yeah.
I think 6 months or several years. And seen as a very good opportunity to
Well, the cheese industry today is worth in exports. I think it's worth about $1 billion of exports every year. So I mean, if you want to talk about the value of that cheese factory at the time, or Sir William Clark, latest scientific farming, the latest methods of cheese making, he developed it here in Victoria. He did it as an example for others to follow. So even today, we've got a lot to thank Sir William Clark for.
I think I read that book was actually
published
in Melbourne.
Yes, it was published in Melbourne, yep. Definitely. So I didn't point that out. Yes, down the bottom, published in Melbourne for Victorians.